From KUER.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today we're talking about online comments. And there's a tweet from the comedy writer Danny Zucker that expresses the point I want to make. I'll clean it up a little. He says, from a Martian's point of view, opinions are like retractable Glurk waste fissures. Everybody's got six. And ain't it the truth? Looking at the stream of comments at the bottom of an article, you can find it all. A measured response, a smart correction, a paranoid rant, an ad hominem attack. The hope was comments would democratize the internet era, transfer power from the gatekeepers to the public. And maybe they have. But there's also the chance they reveal how petty and hateful we can be. Today in the program, we're talking about online comments, why we make them, and why we read them. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The comments section you find at the end of a post or an online article was supposed to be the manifestation of digital democracy, the ability for everybody else, really, to play a part in the information age. And sometimes it actually seems to work that way. You can get some pretty solid arguments and smart corrections and new perspectives. But a lot of the time, maybe even most of the time, that seems like the exception, because it's not hard to find incomprehensible gibberish, nasty, racist, paranoid, self-indulgent rants. And enough of this stuff for people to wonder if comment sections are really useful at all. That's one of those concepts that really looks good on paper but doesn't work in the real cyber world. Today in the program, we're talking about these comment sections. Joining us first on the program is Bob Garfield, a media critic, co-host, of course, of NPR's On the Media. He's also a columnist for Media Post and The Guardian, and he's joining us today from the studios of WNYC in New York City. And Bob, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Doug.
Well, I wanted to start with the idea of these comments sections, you know, as a principle, philosophically, how it was supposed to work. And I guess, in theory, it's a good idea, right? I mean, let people into the conversation.
Can we just talk about something else? Like, something that doesn't upset me as much. War, infectious disease, Fox News Channel, anything that doesn't make me as sad and disappointed about the human race as this subject. Yeah, it's like you said, it's on paper it sounds great, and why not? Because it's the democratization of what hitherto had been, you know, a very pyramidal kind of institution.
Yeah.
Media, and instead of a few appointed voices who get to mouth off to the heart's content, suddenly the whole base of the pyramid can participate, and how can that be bad?
Yeah.
Well, let me count the ways right. That can be bad. You've already listed some of them. Racist rants, vulgarity, ad hominem attacks, and just plain poor thinking. Yeah. The inability to mount an argument, the inability to evidence of this is my particular bête noir, the inability to process media in any way but to validate your own worldview.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that depresses me the most.
David Denby wrote that book, Snark, where he talks about that his big problem is they lack a kind of wit. They're not really that well written in the first place. They lack proportion and irony and the whole, it's bad writing in some way.
Yeah, and this, on my very own program, Ira Glass called me a royalist.
Yeah.
And, I have to cop to that charge because, there is a reason that those people historically who have been at the top of the pyramid are at the top of the pyramid. They have skills.
Right.
They have the combination of critical thinking skills and the ability to express themselves sometimes wittily.
Yeah.
And not everybody who has an email account or an internet connection has those same gifts, and it is just all too apparent all the time. And plus, it's just mean. Plus, it's often stupid.
Yeah.
Plus, it's.
Do you
Let's get to war.
Yeah.
Really. Let's talk about that.
Do you read them at all anymore?
I do.
Yeah.
I'm compulsive about it, not because I'm just on the edge of my seat trying to see what new wrinkle that listeners will have put on a fairly complex, nuanced story.
Yeah.
But because I'm looking for people who have written to say, you got this wrong. Here's how.
Yeah.
Here's why.
Yeah.
And I hate for things to be wrong on our show, and I hate for things to be wrong in my columns. So yeah, I do it. But I'm very seldom delighted by an observation that somebody makes that does in fact add a new wrinkle or some nuance or a different viewpoint to a story that I've participated in, like by writing it,
yeah,
say, or by by conducting an interview. It's happens so seldom.
What do you figure happened? I mean, was it destined to happen like this? That this is just the way it was, or did we somehow not monitor it properly or structure it properly? I mean, was it inevitable that it would happen like this?
Well, with the benefit of hindsight, yeah. Because I mean, just think of it this way: think of how many people in your neighborhood, perfectly nice, respectable, probably bright, well-educated people in your neighborhood, you really want to go to a picnic with and spend 2 hours talking. Now, you're in the talking to folks business, and maybe you are more tolerant than me. But, outside of the people who I interview professionally, there's not a large percentage of the people I encounter I am dying to just get more from.
Yeah.
And again, that's because there's a limited percentage of the population who's very good at critical thinking and expressing their ideas, especially coming up with new ones.
Yeah.
What there is no limit to is the number of people who will consume a given piece of media and be able to look at it as information. Look, this is the royalist in me again, Doug, and I apologize to Ira and the whole world. Here's how I read a newspaper story or an editorial. I look for something that tells me something I didn't know before, yeah, that allows me to expand my knowledge of the world I live in. I do not read articles trying to find out, find some other voice to agree with me. I mean, what is the point of that exercise? And yet, it seems to me that comment sections are just thick with that sort of listener, viewer, and reader.
Mm.
People who just cannot encounter an idea without trying to see whether it fits into the puzzle place that they've got allotted to it. And it's disheartening.
You've talked about on your show that the comment sections of websites are the least innovative parts of the internet. So is there a way to reform this, to change? I mean, there are the New York Times, you've talked about that on your show, where they created those, threading comments so readers can, reply directly to one another, and they have that trusted commenter. I mean, is there a way to reform it, to kind of change it a little bit so it's a little bit more enjoyable or interesting?
Yeah, there are ways. There are mechanisms, not so much for improving the quality of the commentary, but at least for letting the cream rise to the top, right? One is voters having commenters vote on other comments so that the really nasty stuff, the ad hominem attacks, the vulgarities get buried, and the thoughtful comments or the witty ones move to the top, and which of course becomes a virtuous circle. So that's one thing. We on our show, I think this week, will have a piece about sentiment analysis. So that if you doubt your own self-control or skills, you can run your comments or email or whatever it is through this this sentiment analysis,
yeah,
software that suggests it raises red flags about whether you really mean to say that.
Yeah.
So that's another thing, and of course moderation is good in all things, and especially comment sections. Human moderators taking out the nasty stuff, and sometimes even barring people from participating. But, even with all of these mechanisms, we are still left with the structural problem that not everybody has something really valuable to offer. Valid, perhaps, but valuable, I don't know.
Mm. Let me ask you this finally. Are you seeing any anything changing? Like, are people getting tired of it, less of it, or will it always be this way, do you figure?
I got no data. I don't know I can't, you know, prove anything by way of trending. No, I think that there's probably a solution out there to this. Of some sort. I think over time, humanity it will be. Let's see. How can I say this? Because I have an idea that's kind of beginning to coalesce in my head, but I'm having trouble saying it myself. It's still a novelty, comment sections.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they still have an attraction that to me is the equivalent of those guys in the like 1967 LeSabres with Bondo all over them that are passing you on the right and cutting you off on the highway.
Right.
Because it's the only place in the world where they are empowered to do anything. You know, that's the psychology of it.
Yeah.
And I think the same psychology governs a lot of the uglier comment traffic. It is a playground for the id, and you just go crazy. But maybe it will be less appealing over time because been there, done that. I've said the nasty thing in the comment section, and maybe I'll lose interest in this. I mean, who knows? I hope so. And maybe something technologically will get refined. Maybe there will be conventions of civility that begin to be adopted. Hmm. Yeah.
Don't hold your breath.
Or not.
Yeah. Bob Garfield.
I'm not going to.
Bob is co-host of On the Media, which is heard Saturday afternoons at 2, Sunday mornings at 10 here on KUER. And he joined us from the studios of WNYC in New York City. Bob, thanks again.
My pleasure, Doug. Thank you.
Let's go to the phones. Jake is with us in Eastern Utah. Jake, welcome.
Yeah, I just comment I had and was that, you know, when we're talking about these comment boards or comment posts, I used to pay attention to them for a lot of the reasons that your visitor there has mentioned. It was fun to read, and it was, you know, to maybe throw something out there that I thought over time, like you said, they just became, I don't know, for me, they just came out like a trash heap. There was just no pertinent information. The only time that I look at them now that I find them useful is in news situations. Here in Eastern Utah, we had the fires, as everyone knows, recently, as an example. And the news media was posting things on these fires that, first off, anything they posted was half truth. And working and living in the area, we were wanting to get to know what was going on. I could go to the comments sections, and there were people posting on there who were actually there trying to save their home or doing something, and they could say, no, the fire is actually not in this canyon, but it's on this canyon. And so there was, you know, useful information there. But other than that, that's the only time I ever use them anymore, just because they became just a waste of time. That's just my comment.
Do you write comments yourself?
I'm sorry?
Do you write comments? Do you send your own comments?
Very, very seldom, just because I probably have nothing very good to say usually. But
We're glad you called here. Jake, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Mark is with us in Salt Lake. Mark, hi.
How are you?
Fine, thanks. Go ahead.
Hey. Yeah, I enjoy reading the comments because it gives me a very good laugh at times. I think there's sometimes the funniest part of what I'm reading.
Are you at the library or at work or something? You're whispering.
No.
Okay, good. You just have a soft-spoken voice. So
yeah,
what you like about it then, so you say it's the best part of sometimes the stories?
Sometimes.
In what way?
Often I find that the stories are pretty bogus stories. A lot of times I see things are supposedly articles, but they're really opinion pieces. And then you get into some of the comments, and they are so hilarious. And yeah, there's so many that are just not worth reading.
But they give a piece another life.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I've also found that the more intelligent comments are on the more intelligent websites. not to do a deliberate plug here for you, but NPR has some of the most reflective comments because I think they're made by people that maybe are a little bit more intelligent.
Hmm. Well, Mark, we're glad you called. Thanks.
Thanks.
Jesse is with us in Salt Lake. Hi, Jesse.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just kind of wanted to put out the perspective of I used to work in the music industry, more specifically at a venue that was 21 and older, and we threw a show where we was mostly our demographic was a Latino demographic, and we were not able to accept driver's privileges cards as proper identification to prove that you were 21. And so that created a lot of controversy for us, and a news story posted about, you know, us having to turn away hundreds of individuals that had bought tickets for the show, and we did return their ticket, but the way that they wrote the story, it implied that the Depot was a, the Depot is where I was working, was a racist venue.
Yeah.
And it was this huge controversy. And as an employee, we actually had a few different employees go on there. We corrected everybody in saying it was not the employers, it was not the owners, it was not the gateway, it was the law. And we had to follow the law, and we posted it on Facebook, all of our social media outlets, and we also posted up signs as soon as we could to warn individuals that you just can't reach everybody to let them know. And so I felt like it was a good advantage, but at the same time, obviously our venue was called a lot of different vulgar names, and employees were called a lot of vulgar names, you know, obviously being called racist. And it was a hard hit, but I felt like that was a good outlet for us to try and correct individuals and give a business perspective of why we had to do what we had to do.
Set the record straight, yeah. Mm-hmm. Jesse, thanks.
Thank you.
Here's an email from someone in Salt Lake City who writes, I'm a web editor for thedeseretnews.com. Part of my job is to moderate comments on our website. We look at every comment before it's posted on our site, and it is the worst part of my job. We've been moderating our comments for years, and a lot of the nasty stuff has stopped, but there are still a lot of hate-filled comments that come across. He writes, I wanted to go into journalism because I love the human race. I wanted to tell their stories, but when I have to read comments for a couple of hours every day, I actually think I hate most humans. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about that comments section at the end of an online article or post. Some of them are measured and thoughtful, and some of them are hateful and petty. There are those who see comments as a democratizer for this new era of journalism, full of solid arguments and smart corrections, but others see it differently. Joining us now on the program is Bill Reeder. He's an associate professor in the E.W. Scripps School of Journalism at Ohio University. He's conducted several studies on audience feedback, and he's joining us today from the studios of NPR member station WKAR in East Lansing, Michigan. And Bill Reeder, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
I wanted to start with your own interest in you've been thinking about this a long time, writing about it a good amount of time. What got you thinking and interested in it in the first place? What was the thing you made of these comment sections?
When I first started working in newspaper journalism, one of my early jobs was at a newspaper that had an anonymous call-in forum, what a lot of newspapers had back in the 80s and 90s, and I hated it. I mean, I heard Bob Garfield on earlier, and he's, you know, basically my sentiments then were his now. But then in the late 1990s, I became an editorial page editor at a daily newspaper in a pretty large college town in Pennsylvania. And my job was to be the referee for the comments, the letters to the editor. And my job in that situation was to find reasons to say yes to publish rather than to look for reasons to say no. And my attitudes changed as I started working directly with letter writers, which, you know, at a smaller newspaper, it's a lot easier to have those types of personal relationships with writers. And I started to appreciate more how those forums are not about us, the journalists, and what was starting to – what started to kind
wait,
of
wait,
change
wait,
my
wait,
mind.
Wait, you mean not about us as journalists in terms of the stories we write or not about our egos as the people who presented this information?
Well, both those, but also these values that were ingrained in us in journalism school and through professional conferences and professional interactions and, you know, certainly in the prize-seeking aspects of journalism.
Yeah.
And to be honest, I started to feel like, man, this is a pretty snobby, arrogant position for journalists to be taking, that somehow we want the people, the quote, you know, citizens who we invite to participate in our forum to understand and appreciate our values of what we consider, quote, bright and educated, or what we consider to be intelligent and witty. And also for us to define what we think the forum should be when it's – and then turn around in the same thing and say, this is your forum. This is the forum for the public. This is your chance to have your say. And then if they don't say things in a manner that we like, we're like, you know what? I don't really like this forum so much.
Right. But, you know, you hear that response that – but this is our job. It is our job to be the gatekeeper. That's why people go to us. They, you know, they could go out and get anyone's opinion. But you're a journalist. You were trained to find facts and to apply, you know, to temper it with, you know, perspective. You know what I mean? So how do you respond to that? That yes, you're right, that there's that kind of arrogant sensibility, but that is our job, is to provide that gatekeeper role.
Sure, but when I go to the dentist office, I don't tell the dentist to do what I do as a journalist. I expect the dentist to do what a dentist does,
yeah.
You know, and when I go and when I park in a public parking garage, I don't expect the person I'm interacting with at the payment window to understand me on my terms. And so I think that, you know, if you're going to provide what we call a public forum, you know, and we have this ideal of it being kind of this like cotillion like virtual village square.
Yeah.
And then we throw it open to all comers and it turns out that they're people. There are people who sometimes are angry and frustrated, not all of whom are as good at writing. You know, maybe the person can fix your car very quickly. Maybe the person's a great plumber or an excellent ER nurse, but may not necessarily be a great writer.
Mm.
And maybe in the writing isn't conveying the intelligence behind the argument. The expression isn't coming through quite clean, but that's the point of the forum, is that it's the people's voice, not the people channeling our journalistic ideals of what is considered quality.
Mm.
And in that way, it is egalitarian, including the nastiness, including the people using the same rhetoric that they would use in a bar room with their buddies or at a backyard barbecue or, you know, like I do often. I love On the Media, but I yell at Bob all the time through the radio.
Right.
Because he is, you know, I like his style, but he is snarky. He is often arrogant in the way he interacts with people. He's dismissive sometimes of opinions that he disagrees with. And that's great. And you know, I'm not criticizing Bob, but I'm just saying that to turn around and then say people who are trying to be snarky and dismissive and arrogant and rude but not doing it quite as well aren't worthy of having a say.
Yeah, you're saying people are entitled to a response.
Well, sure.
Yeah,
sure. If we provide a forum, then they're entitled to have access to the forum.
Yeah, yeah.
If we don't want to hear the responses, then we shouldn't offer the forum.
Right, right. Let's go back to the phones. Jameson is with us in Salt Lake. Jameson, welcome.
Hi, Doug. How's it going?
Great.
I hate to bring such a silly word into such a good conversation, but I think when you're talking about something like this, you have to address the trolls, which whenever I'm reading through comments and I see these ugly, ugly words that people are using, I just assume that that particular person is a troll.
Hmm.
Right. And trolls are, well, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, no. I was just going to say that there's kind of people who are trying to evoke a negative response from people because it feeds them somehow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sure. And I always think of the troll as the very large drunken boar in the bar room who is trying to make sure everybody hears his conversation with his friends.
Right.
You know, it's like there's some level of insecurity probably there, and probably some not quite well treated underlying issues. But, you know, trolls, we don't have very good numbers quite yet about all this.
Yeah.
Trolls make up a very small percentage of people who participate in comment forums. And people who participate in comment forums make up a very small percentage of people who actually read them.
Right. So who are those people?
They're the lurkers. They're the lurkers who sit back, many of whom who sit back and read the forums because they like to see what the trolls are going to do. Huh. And the trolls are going in to bait. Sometimes the trolls are actually paid, what we call sock puppets.
Yeah.
These are people who are paid by special interest groups to go in and try to either change the dialogue away from the main topic, or it is actually a tactic that if a troll becomes so insistent and so obnoxious that it'll just shut down the comments. It's like you'll see 200 comments and 203 through 205 is from this troll, and then that's it. The people just lose interest and go out of the forum.
Yeah. Are the people who comment I'm not talking about the trolls now. Someone who wants to have a comment, are they a certain breed that's always been around? I mean, are these the same kinds of people who, for example, back in the day wrote to the editorial page of a newspaper? Does that make sense?
The research in this is very new. Yeah. And so, I don't want to make broad generalizations based on a few recent studies, but there have been some studies into this. And the answer is yeah. The demographic studies we did on Letters to the Editor were basically white, middle class, usually leaning a little bit to the right, but usually pretty center, very stable in their community types, who were very interested in public policy and social issues, and I think that's carrying forward to the comments. Except I would say the gender issue is probably there's probably a lot more women involved.
Hmm. Let me read an email from Robert. Robert writes, many people post hateful or just stupid comments because they can hide behind the anonymity of an avatar. If people are required to identify themselves with a personal account or even sign a full name before they comment, that often improves the quality of the comments. Now, Bill Reeder, this is something that you've looked into. And I guess what you found is to talk about this question of anonymity, because it seems like what you found is that being anonymous doesn't necessarily improve the quality of the letter or make people more civil.
No, I don't know how this meme came about, and it really is a meme. It goes back to the 1950s, but people seem to assume that the incivility in comments, the impoliteness in comments, is directly caused by anonymity. We have absolutely no data to support that claim of causation. Just none. There's zero. Zilch. And to be honest, people do lots of nice things anonymously. Every time I go into a fast food restaurant or someplace where there's a donation jar, there's money in the jar. Yeah. There's no names attached to the money. So, people do charitable things. People open doors for one another, and then it's like, oh, by the way, here's my business card. This is who I am.
Yeah.
So there's all kinds of altruistic and generous things that are done anonymously. And then, of course, anonymity is something that gets the truth out. I mean, there's a reason why medical research and psychological research and public opinion research is not only very protective of the identity of the participants, but, in certain cases, by law, have to keep them anonymous. The main reason for anonymity in that type of scholarly research or applied research is to get people to give frank answers. Mm. I mean, I read a study last year about end-of-care decision-making by physicians, basically, euthanasia without calling it euthanasia, pushing a little bit extra morphine to help the person end the suffering and things like that. If the doctors had to be identified, they would never be honest about end-of-care treatment techniques. But when you give them the anonymity, they can be perfectly frank about the things they do to alleviate suffering and to bring the person's life to an end, knowing full well that's where it's going in the next few days anyway, just to end the suffering.
But
I mean, that's the kind of thing that we need to remember with anonymity, is that it's not always negative, negative, negative.
Yeah. See, I get where anonymity is crucial when, like, an employee is trying to raise a sensitive issue or blow a whistle. But what's so wrong in those other circumstances with someone, asking someone to be accountable for their comments, to say, just list your name? What's wrong with making them accountable? And how would that transform the way they, would they be more?
They would be more euphemistic. They would be less forthright about how they feel.
Huh.
They would be less. I mean,
that's interesting.
We did a study back in 2003 where we asked people about letter writing habits, letters to the editor. And we asked, we didn't just ask about have you written a letter, was it published and things like that, and then get the demographic data. But we also asked people, have you ever written a letter and not have it published? And then we asked it, to those who had never written a letter, would you write a letter to the editor if your name wouldn't be published with it? And we saw huge spikes among women, racial minorities, the very young and the very old. People on either end of the financial spectrum, people who were, you know, living in poverty and people who had lots and lots of money. And so basically what we saw were groups that are, you know, not being represented in the conversation. The conversation is, for lack of a better term, being dominated by white middle class men, educated men. People who are not fitting that demographic did not participate because they would have to give their names.
Let's go back to the phones. Tammy is with us in Austin, Texas. Tammy, hi.
Hi. I think an article can evoke a passionate response. So a reader posts an instant comment. Then afterwards they think, oh, that was dumb. I wish I had not written that. And then they think, well, they don't have the time to write a complete, intelligent sentence, maybe something that's witty, you know, on the spot. I know that a lot of times I'm intimidated to do that. There's that magazine, Stunstone Magazine, and when I go to write an article, I think, oh, all these people are so intelligent, I don't dare write something that's, you know, that's not really good. And I actually told someone about that, and they said, oh, no, we never write anything instantly. We go to Word, and we write about it for days, and then we submit it. And I said, oh, no wonder your comments are so good. So I think that happens quite a bit. And with Bob Garfield, I was always going to write him a great letter of how much I like his things. But, gosh, if he just wants something opposing, I'm not going to write him a letter of thank you.
You should. Give him a break. Give him a break.
Yeah, I do. I do. I listen to his show every week.
You should. Right? Yeah.
Good. So okay. Is yours. Thank you.
Tammy, thanks. So, Bill Reeder, talk about that. I mean, it's interesting. So what Tammy is saying is, look, sometimes it's just a knee-jerk emotional response. We shouldn't expect it to be perfect. And as you say, it's an honest response.
Right. Well, and that's an excellent, excellent comment because, you know, very early in the 20th century when we started to see letters to the editor sections being kind of congealed into a single space in the papers and actually labeled as letters to the editor and eventually gravitating toward the op-ed pages and the opinion pages as being kind of, you know, on par with the editorials, becoming professionalized. They would have names. Some of them would have names like the Social Safety Valve. You know,
yeah.
And, you know, the cathartic value of letters to the editor and comments is very important. I mean, you know, we live in a country that right now we are very divided, according to the polls, ideologically and partisanly. And yet, you know, even the last election, a few elections, as contentious as they were, there were no bullets. There were no firebombs. You know, it was as peaceful a transition of power as you're going to get when people were at each other's throats rhetorically. And I think that's because we have these cathartic mechanisms where people can vent their frustrations, their anger, where people can get the politically incorrect opinions that they have festering inside them out into the open. And then, of course, we have no idea how people feel afterward. Do they feel relieved? Do they feel regretful? Do they get the buyer's remorse of having hit send? Do they review how other people respond to their comments? Do they change their mind and their ideas? Do they actually grow as people by engaging in the dialogue? Do they learn to become better writers? You know, there's so much potential of positive, long-term positive to come from these forums, which it's a relatively new phenomenon. I think it's a little too early to start throwing baby out with the bathwater and saying, you must sign your name.
Bill Reeder is with us. He teaches in the E.W. Scripps School of Journalism at Ohio University. And Tammy, thanks again. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about those comment sections at the end of online articles or posts. Jack Hitt is joining us in the program now. He's a journalist who writes regularly for The New York Times Magazine and The New Yorker, contributes also to public radio's This American Life. His latest book is called Bunch of Amateurs, A Search for the American Character, joining us from his home in Connecticut. And Jack, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So I don't want to kind of oversimplify the way you feel about it, but I get a sense that, you do like them. Here's something you wrote. You said, these days, the comment sections of any engaging article is almost as necessary a read as the piece itself. So explain that.
Well, quite often, to be honest, we journalists get things wrong, small things, sometimes big things. Sometimes the entire angle of how we've approached something is wrong. Unfortunately for us, most of those corrections come after we've published with our name attached at the top of the piece. But I think in the last 10 years, journalists have definitely changed the way they've both written and fact-checked their stories, because they now know that not one or two people are going to write in letters to the editor, but probably hundreds, if not thousands, of people are going to comb over your entire piece and go and hold your feet to the fire on everything from, a that which clause to the budget surplus number to whatever. And now, we journalists expect that. We armor ourselves for the inevitable onslaught of almost entirely criticism at the end of a piece. I will say, though, that a lot of that criticism is really good.
Yeah.
It's people who know specifics about one small thing, and they write in and basically sting you for it. I have to say, I now fact check everything I do, and then I submit it to a fact checker to fact check.
Yeah.
And part of it is because of the online comments.
But how?
So I'm a big fan of them. I think they've made better journalists out of all of us.
But how do you sift through, like as a consumer, how do you sift through or wade through the dreck, the really nasty nonsense?
Okay, let me tell you how I do that. I just ignore it. I've never written a piece where someone hasn't called me a communist or a fascist or an idiot or a retard or something horrible. Yeah. I mean, they're just terrible words used constantly in comments, okay? Those are the unpoliced ones. People will just come after you with the rudest, nastiest things. You know what? That's now just such a regular feature, I don't even see it. I just scroll right past those. Now, a number of different sites have gotten very good at policing their sites. So, for example, go back to your previous guest. The New York Times now, obviously curates its comments, so you don't get too much of the horrible stuff. But more than that, and speaking of anonymity, if you're a regular commenter there and your comments are regularly screened and then published, right, you achieve a kind of like high status where you can skip the, I don't know if you skip it, but you're more quickly published, right?
Right.
And that allows for a certain anonymity as well. So even though there are anonymous writers, you can achieve a certain credibility just like, Alexander Hamilton did with his anonymous writings in the Federalist Papers, right? You achieve a certain credibility by becoming known, however anonymous, by the credibility of your comments, right?
Yeah.
So there are ways to do this. A lot of papers now curate. I know that Ta-Nehisi Coates, the writer of the Atlantic blog, has compared curating his own site to hosting a cocktail party.
Right.
You're not going to let one of your guests turn around and call another guest at the table a slut, because that would just be rude, even if it were true.
Right.
Right. You just wouldn't allow that to happen, right? You just don't. Good people don't allow that kind of conversation to happen at their table. And so at Coates' blog, you're not allowed to talk like that because he's the host of the table, right? And I think we're all responsible for that. For our own blogs, our own websites, and whatever. Now, like I say, a lot of people, they just allow any old comments to happen. I think after 10 or so years of just people flaming each other in the rudest possible, nastiest, most obscene ways,
we've all just sort of gotten, it's like seeing porn online. You just look, you know, oh, click off, move on.
Right.
It's just there.
Yeah.
It's just a nasty kind of side effect of the internet, right?
Yeah.
Now, let's just talk about the good stuff. There are plenty of cases where the mob rule of online comments have produced really great things once you look past all the obscenities.
Yeah.
For example, last year, there were a number of scientists claimed that they had found arsenic-based life, right? This was a fairly big scandal at the time, but what was really interesting about it is that scientists basically kind of, you know, just mobbed this study, went through every little detail. Basically, in 48 hours, they had disproven the entire claim, and the folks had to retract it. Now, look, normally things like that take forever to go through the stately, you know, and slow process of empirical verification. But now online science moves very quickly to sort of push out crappy studies.
Yeah.
Right? This is happening repeatedly.
It seems like it's also changing the way we think of any piece, any article itself, because it doesn't just sit there anymore. I mean, it's the whole comment part is a give and take, and it changes the dynamic of the piece itself. It's something that you've written about that it just seems like it's not a complete experience without the comment part.
Look, you know, as a reporter, I go out, I talk to a bunch of people, I try to figure out basically the fairest possible way, not the most objective, because of course, I think we all know now in the age of Rush Limbaugh, there's no such thing as objective. There's just a lot of people talking.
Yeah.
And I think what you want to do is figure out the fairest way to present that story. And even after you do that, people are going to weigh in and point out things that maybe you didn't see or maybe do that politely or maybe rudely, and change the shape of the story. And let me just say, by the way, another item in this that you have to consider, especially for writers out there, I find the comment sections to be a great place to find new story ideas.
Right.
Because you've got basically thousands of people who are pouncing on the story saying, you missed this whole thing over here. It's like, oh. And then that takes you down a new road toward the new. I mean, any writer is just trying to find something new to write about. That's often very hard to find, especially in a nation of hacks who basically repeat the same sort of ideological nonsense over and over and over again. It's very hard to find new. And one of the great sources of the new is readers' comments.
Yeah. Let me ask you this finally. What do you think the comments, and maybe I guess I'm talking about the bad ones that I notice.
Mm-hmm.
What do they reveal, do you think, about, you know, about human nature? Like that we can be pretty petty, or that we're opinionated, or that we want to be heard? Have you drawn any conclusions about that?
No, I think, you know, the kind of flaming comments that you see at the end of articles are like, you know, my uncle getting drunk on Thanksgiving and shouting and pounding the table and denouncing whatever it is that he doesn't like politically.
Right.
These are people who just feel suddenly emboldened, either because of booze or the anonymity of online or whatever it is, to just suddenly vent their most horrible thoughts, uncurated, unmediated, and unthought through. And they just say these terrible things. Look, I used to edit the letters to the editor section of Harper's Magazine back when I was an editor there. We all had to sort of do it from, you know, month to month. And even then, you know, most of the letters we got were just terrible, horrible, you know, crayon written sort of scrawl, margin to margin, top to bottom. Crazy people.
Yeah.
We threw those out. The problem with online comments is that you can't throw out the crazy people anymore. So now we're just getting a glimpse of what it's like to know what a letters to the editor, you know, guy had to deal with 25 years ago. Now everybody gets to see that.
Jack Hitt, his most recent book is called Bunch of Amateurs, joined us from his home in Connecticut. Jack, thanks.
Thank you so much.
Let's go back to the phones. Kim has been waiting in Salt Lake. Hi, Kim.
Hi. I just wanted to call in as somebody who occasionally does engage in the comments section. On different articles or even just pictures or things that people post, like on Facebook and whatnot.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think that, like, sometimes I only will comment on something if I do find something inconsistent or something hypocritical about the article or about the comments that people are making. they'll just kind of point that out. I try to do it nicely. I don't consider myself a troll.
Right.
I don't say hateful things.
But you like, what's the inclination though that appeals to you about doing this? Is trying to get it right, or you want to be involved somehow? You want someone to know that, hey, I read this thing. I should point this out to you. I mean, what's the thing that you get out of that experience?
I think part of it is I want people to think a little more before they just spew whatever onto the internet for everyone to hear.
Yeah.
Like think about what they're saying. So I maybe try to get them to think about it a little deeper, whatever it is. Something like that. Or sometimes I'll just throw out a different argument, maybe do the devil's advocate kind of thing. Even if I agree with what they're saying, I might think, well,
You want to get a conversation going. You want to stir the pot.
Yeah. If I see too many people just agreeing all with each other, I'm like, well, that's not helpful. What if this were to happen? What about this scenario? You know, would that change things? So I do try to make it a conversation, I guess.
Yeah. Well, Kim, thanks.
Uh-huh.
Let's go back to Bill Reeder, of course, associate professor in the E.W. Scripps School of Journalism at Ohio University, joining us today from East Lansing, Michigan. Bill Reeder, it's interesting. It seems like because you've sort of looked at the history of the way we've engaged readers, you know, in the past in newspapers and now online. Are we headed back to where we were before? You know, there was it seems like there was this kind of detachment at some point. Now we said, all right, I'm a professional journalist and I'm the only one who has say. And we were detached from audience comments. Now we're going back to where we were before, where there wasn't that division or that dividing point.
I think that the rhetoric might be going back and the willingness of people to express, you know, hard opinions. Rather than euphemized opinions or elegant opinions or, you know, I think we're getting back to the real meaning of civility, which is the status of the civilian population, the citizenry, and what the citizenry cares about, rather than the hoi polloi definition of civility, which is, you know, politeness and refinement and kind of being a high society. But by the same token, I think we're moving in some really interesting new directions. And probably the most interesting new direction is that we really are seeing the breadth of rhetorical tactics used in our very complex and pluralistic society. The gatekeepers are irrelevant when there's no fence on either side of the gate.
Right.
And so, you know, we still have some old school journalists who are trained in the 1920s. Or the 20th century, trained by people who were trained by people who worked in the 1960s, who are trying to keep alive this old ideal that somehow, you know, as journalists, we're supposed to be in control. And the control thing it's a moot point now. And in fact, the media who still try to exhibit that kind of gatekeeping control are the ones that are suffering the most, the really big newspapers, the really big broadcasting networks and stuff. And then, you know, the vast majority of journalism in this country is done at the local and regional level. I mean, the average newspaper in the United States is not the New York Times. It's at 7,500 circulation weekly in some rural part of the country or a suburb. And, you know, they are seeing robust involvement of their local citizenry and arguing and debating important issues and also issues that we as journalists may not think are important, but the public does. And so like Jack said earlier, I mean, these are great sources for story ideas. These are great ways to keep a pulse on what's going on in the population. And the other thing is that whether you like them or not as a journalist, and it really made me sad to hear about the Deseret News reporter who hates his job of reviewing that, he's probably not the right journalist to be in that job, because in our field there are journalists who love the, like, you know, leave it all on the court types of First Amendment stuff, and those are the ones who should be hired to be curators, managers, referees, what have you.
But you've got to admit, Bill Reeder, it gets discouraging. Even though, let's say the trolls only represent a portion of it. And this is Bob came back. You know, he uses words like discouraged and sad. You know, when you hear that kind of, there is some sense that it's a pretty coarse way that we're talking to each other these days, Maybe that doesn't represent the whole, but you get why people get discouraged, don't you?
Do you think the way Rush Limbaugh talks to people is not coarse? I mean, I think in a lot of ways people are just reflecting the culture in which we live.
Huh.
One of the comments I read recently, and I have a new study that just came out, one of them basically said that the difference between anonymity and non-anonymity is the paycheck, because politicians can just be as nasty and rude, and so can working journalists can be just as nasty and rude as anybody else, but they get paid to put their name on their opinions. And I actually see that. You know, when you have columnists coming on and using all kinds of nasty names to refer to anonymous people, reptilian, cesspool, scumbags, you know, gutless cowards, all this stuff, how does that elevate the debate? How is being disrespectful of people who choose to write anonymously, and I'm not talking about trolls, I'm just talking about people who write anonymously, how does that advance the rhetoric? I think that, you know, these comments reflect the society as it is, not the society as, you know, the elite want it to be.
Bill Reeder, Associate Professor in the E.W. Scripps School of Journalism at Ohio University. Thanks very much for the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thanks to those of you who've called in and who've written to us. Go to our website. You can continue the conversation. It'll be interesting to hear what you have to say. Radio West, a production of KUER News. I'm Doug Fabrizio.